The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I had the pleasure recently of attending a brilliant panel discussion entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Dismantling Racism and Colonialism Through Drug Policy Reform. It was organized by Harm Reduction International in collaboration with the UK's Centre for Expertise on Drugs and Drugs Law, RELEASE, De Justicia, the International Drug Policy Consortium, the Transnational Institute, and Voices of Community Action and Leadership, or VOCAL, in Kenya. We're going to hear from some of the speakers on today's show. First, here's Kojo Corum. He's a writer, attorney, and lecturer in law at the Birkbeck School of Law in the UK.
I think we've really got to try and begin the story with the way in which the globalization and commodification of psychoactive substances that we now call drugs is really interwoven with the European colonial project. Now, of course, anthropologists have shown that societies from as far back as they can record have had some sort of engagement with psychoactive substances, whether that be religious or ritualistic or cultural. But in terms of becoming global commodities that are being traded and consumed across a transnational marketplace, the use of what we now call drugs really exploded with the European colonial project. In fact, you could say that psychoactive substances drove the European colonial project in many of its specificities. Think about some of the more significant substances that become global commodities in this era: tobacco, sugar, coffee, and alongside that, we need to think about opium, and we need to think about marijuana, and we need to think about cocaine. We need to think about the enormous cocaine plantations that the Dutch Empire used to produce in its East Indies and in Java, what we now call Indonesia. We need to think about the way in which in the 19th century, the British Empire, which we now will see from my other speakers, has had this huge legacy of prohibition across the world, was in fact the world's most successful and largest treaty. He describes the attempt to prohibit the sale of opium as being evil in and of itself. But yet, less than a century later, we get to the middle of the 20th century, as scholars like Rick Lyons have shown, in the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs in 1961, the foundation of our current system of international drug prohibition, we have in the preamble the use and trade of drugs as being described as evil, one of the very few examples of that language being used in international law. How do we get that transition in less than a century from the trade and commercialization of drugs being seen as an essential part of European colonial capitalism to being this, this threat to humankind that needs to be expunged with the violent mobilization of the law? I think that has a lot to do with the way in which ideas around colonial ordering and racial ordering shift and adapt in this intervening period. And as Colleen kind of identified in her introduction, it has a lot to do with the emergence of the United States of America and its particular form of a new post-colonial imperialism. Because, of course, America understands itself as not a colonial state. In fact, as in its founding myth, an anti-colonial state with its opposition towards British colonialism. But its relationship with drug prohibition is tied to its own imperial ambitions. Primarily, the actions that were taken in the United States when it received Philippines alongside other places like Guam and Cuba following the Treaty of Paris, following the conclusion of the war with Spain in 1898. But it picks up, for the purposes of drug prohibition, significantly the Philippines. And as part of its project of remaking the native population of the Philippines, one of the big ambitions of the American state at that particular time is to try and remove the usage and consumption of opium from the culture of this particular new colony of theirs. We can look at the writings of Charles Henry Brent, who actually ended up being the chairman of the very first international drug prohibition conference, when the United States used its rising power to bring the likes of the United Kingdom, France, and the other major European powers to the table with the Shanghai Opium Commission in 1909. Charles Henry Brent says that one of the major blockages from making the native population into Christians is their use of opium. And this needs to be removed in order to stop this drug stealing the souls of the natives, as well as the Americans who are living in this colony, in his words. And so from the 1909 Shanghai Opium Commission, we get this new era of understanding the relationship between drugs and the kind of civilizing mission of European colonialism, in which the expulsion of drugs, the removal of drugs, is seen as a necessary element from turning the more kind of backward and uncivilized native people into this vision of the rarefied and sovereign civilized subject. But of course, there's a real bind in that, because what we see happening with this early era of American drug prohibition is this insistence on turning the natives into civilized subjects, whilst at the same time having this insistence that they can never be as civilized as the white Americans in which they are supposed to be modeling. And so you get this bind that the individuals are caught in, and this leads to the acceleration of a legal and political system that facilitates greater and greater violence upon those individuals who are seen as being associated with these dangerous psychoactive substances. And we can see that when we start to look at the statistical information around who have been the people who have suffered the heaviest weight of international and national drug prohibition in the subsequent years. We can look at the geographical ordering of international drug prohibition, the what used to be known as the supply side heavy geographical weight of it, where those countries and those areas that were seen as producing and cultivating these substances face the lion's share of the violence of counter-narcotics programs, whether we think about Plan Colombia or the Meridian Initiative or all these other examples of places in Latin America or the Horn of Africa, Far East Asia, all of these places facing the violence of international drug prohibition. Even when we look inside the countries of the so-called consumer areas, the global north, the United States and the United Kingdom, we can start to see, again, that racial ordering behind who's facing the heaviest weight of international drug prohibition. We look at the way in which the war on drugs became the facilitator of the conveyor belt into a system of mass incarceration for huge amounts of the Black American community. We can look at the way in the United Kingdom, drugs continue to be the main reason behind stop and search, which of course has huge disproportionate impact upon the Black British community and other ethnic minority communities. And so we can see some of the ways in which the history and the way in which what some people describe as the American experiment of international drug prohibition, which really became one of the flagship foreign policies of the United States of America, one of the things that are used to try and create a particular universal vision of what a civilized post-colonial world might look like, has had the consequences of actually reproducing and in some cases accelerating the racial and geographical divisions within the world.
That was Kojo Corum, an attorney and lecturer in law at the Birkbeck School of Law, speaking on a panel entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Dismantling Racism and Colonialism Through Drug Policy Reform, which was organized recently by Harm Reduction International. Sean Shelley is the Policy, Advocacy, and Human Rights Manager with TB-HIV Care in South Africa.
So if we look at South Africa, we obviously have the sort of legacy of apartheid in the country, which was kind of a dystopian colonialist dream in a way, where we had people oppressed, we had the creation of labor through people, and it was Robert Sobukwe who made this statement about the Shambok, which became the symbol of colonialism and oppression in South Africa. And really what we saw in South Africa was the attempt to divide people and to take over the natural resources of the country, which certainly happened. And then when we finally got to a stage of overcoming apartheid and dismantling the apartheid system, there was a lot of critical examination of many of the imposed policies and ways of looking at things. But there were also a number of facts that were accepted as facts that possibly weren't facts. They were just ideas. And it was Fanon who said, you know, that imperialism leaves behind germs of rot. And certainly there were germs of rot in South Africa. And these accepted facts, or one of the biggest accepted facts, as we've heard, was the presumption that all drugs were evil. And this led to the kind of acceptance that it was okay to target people. And the irony of the statement, which you see here about making our own Shambok, is that it really shows how the process of colonialism colonizes not only the land, but the people as well, to become a perpetual machine of oppression against themselves, and to keep people in a struggle which is artificially created. And the war on drugs certainly has done that. And we got politicians comparing drug use to apartheid, which is just a shocking thing that wasn't even spoken out against. This particular statement that you see here was made by the leader of the opposition in South Africa, and there were no complaints. You know, they feel that, you know, drug use is as bad as apartheid to some people, you know, which it clearly is not even, couldn't even be in the same category. And what this led to was that we had this shifting of resources that were previously used to police apartheid, and we shifted them to the policing of drugs. And what I mean by resources is not only the CASPERs, the militarized vehicles, the military, the physical shifting of resources, but I'm talking about resources such as the bypassing of certain laws. I'm talking about the resources of the way in which certain human rights violations were considered justifiable under the apartheid regime. They are now justifiable in the war on drugs. And so we've witnessed the perpetuation of apartheid style policing and a kind of continuation of a lot of the apartheid human rights abuses and travesties of justice under the war on drugs. There's been a repurposing of the same thinking. And certainly communities have been terrorized more recently by a different kind of gang, which is the state gang of the police and the army. And so we've seen the perpetuation of the colonial and the imperial through the myth of the international, but this continues. Okay, and the belief that drug use is so problematic, we've seen things like the justification of Chinese experts training police in South Africa. We've got the Drug Enforcement Agency training police in South Africa. Now, if anybody thinks that the Drug Enforcement Agency has got an ounce of credibility left, you know, they obviously haven't been doing much of the reading or even looking at the press, because this is a major problem. They're a sort of a pariah organization, even in their own country. And here we are getting them to train people in an African context where we've heard previously there wasn't much focus on criminalizing drug use. You know, this is definitely the most colonial of policies that we currently have in South Africa, one of the most colonial. It's not the most, perhaps, but it's one of them, certainly. And if we look at some of the reports that we've got in the press, this constant presence in the law enforcement world of American influence, in particular Chinese influence as well. We also have the Russian African anti-drug dialogue. So we've got these three superpowers competing in a way to put their ideas into a country which is supposed to be getting rid of imperialism and colonialism. And we see it even in a more subtle way. And so we've got the South African National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Use, and they are funded largely now by the American Department of State. And if we look a little bit more closely, we find that the International Technology Transfer Center, which replaces the ATTC, and just to be clear, I'm actually on the advisory board of them, may need to keep an eye on things, but they are then supporting and supported by the same mechanisms that support the International Society of Substance Use Professionals, which might sound very innocent and innocuous, but in actual fact, behind that, you've got the SICAD, the Inter-American Drug Abuse Control Commission. You've then got the Bureau of Narcotics, International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. And effectively, we've got the continuation of imperialist ideas and a different kind of colonizing, in that we are colonizing police forces. We're putting foreign police forces and personnel and expertise on the ground in South Africa. And this is particularly problematic when we look at, for example, a lot of the work that's being promoted. It's purely on demand and supply reduction. And we're finding that the conflation of between drugs and drug use and international, transnational crime is increasing. And so we're getting calls to bring back the death penalty for drug sellers, for example, not realizing that the vast majority of drug sellers are just subsistence sellers. So we must remember that decolonization is not simply the absence of the colonizer. It was Steve Biko who said the most potent weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And we're certainly seeing how we haven't critically examined issues of drug policy in South Africa, how we have assumed that the international myth that all drugs are bad and dangerous and they are capable of great evil, we've assumed that to be correct. And this has justified all manner of continued forms of imperial ideas and colonization taking place in South Africa. Hopefully, we will get to an end of that, and we will finally wake up and bring back the activists in our communities who will act again, not against their brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles who happen to use drugs, but will actually act against the powers that continue to enforce the oppression and pursue the interests of capital and finance and economic division, rather than building a strong nation and a free nation. I will give some of the solutions a little bit later, but just to finish, I'm paraphrasing Steve Biko there a little bit. My apologies if anybody's offended by that, but I think that it's true, and it's one of the most beautiful statements I've seen, is in time we shall be in a position to bestow on South Africa, and indeed people who use drugs, the greatest possible gift, a more human face. And if we can do that, I think we're well on the way to overcoming the terrible impacts of colonization and imperialism in South Africa, especially when it comes to people who use drugs. So I'm going to leave it there, and thank you to my fellow speakers who've highlighted many of the issues which we are facing here in South Africa as well.
That was Sean Shelley with TB HIV Care in South Africa, speaking on a panel entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Dismantling Racism and Colonialism Through Drug Policy Reform, which was organized recently by Harm Reduction International. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Here's Trippi Tandon, Deputy Director of the Lawyers Collective in India.
Thank you, Colleen. And before presenting the Indian perspective, I just wanted to flag two broader questions, before we embark on this whole narrative around decolonizing drug policies. I think the first is whether the question of the colonial mindsets influencing the way we respond to drugs can be divorced from the question of alcohol and alcohol policies, because as many of the speakers pointed out, there was a particular mindset of the colonizing state that viewed the use of plant-based drugs, particularly cannabis, opium, coca, as harmful, whereas not alcohol use. And of course, those who defended the use of cannabis and opium would can be quoted as saying, as one commentator from India said, opium may be regarded as the Indian parallel to wine and beer, may be regarded as wine and beer in Europe and America. And of course, for some anti-colonial crusaders like Gandhi, who was regarded as the father of the Indian independence movement, the fight against colonialism was intertwined with the fight against what he called intoxicants that rob people of their physical, moral, and spiritual capacities. So for Gandhi, the question was drugs, drink, and devil. And that's what he kind of founded the movement for independence here on. So really, I think, and of course, whether colonial mindsets are responsible for the fact that for drugs, they became a subject matter of international treaties and conventions, whereas alcohol escaped that project. So I think the question of alcohol policies cannot, in my opinion, be, divorced or excluded from this narrative of decolonizing drug policies and questioning prohibition as a colonial project. A related issue is that of religious prescriptions and how they may be informing prohibition in several countries, especially Islamic countries. So speaking for South Asia, I know that in Bangladesh, the Narcotics Control Act includes alcohol as a Schedule B substance. And in Pakistan, in addition to drug control laws, you have the Hudud law based on Sharia principles, which criminalizes the consumption of drugs. And I'm also raising this because as Gojo and others pointed out, colonial mindsets, of course, were founded on Victorian and evangelical values, and that viewed natural plant-based drugs a particular way as resulting in the uncivilized native Indian. So I think the question of religion may also be explored as part of this whole decolonization narrative, and how whether we can escape that question if you're talking about reforming drug laws in their entirety. Coming now to the Indian experience, which I think to some extent follows what the panelists from Kenya and South Africa have spoken, but also substantially departs from that, is that, of course, the use of cannabis and opium for social, cultural, spiritual, medicinal use is, well known in South Asia, centuries old. And the colonial state, in fact, did not introduce prohibition, but rather introduced commercially driven, revenue-oriented regulations to really capture the opium economy, regulation from seed to sale, as we now call it, through opium acts, and also brought cannabis under the purview of provincial excise laws to bring in a system of licensing and taxation. In fact, some aspects of this regulatory apparatus are still in force in India, such as the district opium officers who oversee the licensed opium cultivation and production in many parts of India. And of course, bhang and ganja still appear in the provincial state excise laws. And if India were to regulate cannabis, it had simply to just switch on this aspect of the law, which is in place. And ironically, it was in fact 100 years ago, precisely 100 years ago, when the nationalist movement in India started to view opium as, as perhaps Gojo also pointed out, at the opium trade as being responsible for maintaining, British colonial rule in the country. And there was this intertwining of anti-opium sentiments with anti-colonial sentiments, a glimpse of which may be seen in a resolution that the Indian National Congress passed in 1924. If I would just read a quote. It says Congress is of the opinion that the policy of the government of India in using the drink and drug habit of the people as a source of revenue is detrimental to the moral welfare of India and would therefore welcome its abolition. So ironically, it was the government of India, the colonial state that argued that the problem of opium abuse was rare in Indian society and that the moderate use of opium and cannabis did not lead to any harm, a position that most of us reformers would today identify with. And it was the Indian nationalists, the anti-colonial movement, which joined hands with evangelicals and the temperance movement in Britain to support prohibition. And as a result of this, post-independence, prohibitionist sentiments are now ingrained in the Indian constitution, where we have fortunately a non-binding directory principle, which calls upon the state to, in addition to raising the standard of living, nutrition and public health of citizens, to also bring about the prohibition of consumption of drink and drugs that are injurious to health. Curiously, this article is not talked about in the context of alcohol, but is always cited in support of criminalization of drug use. In fact, much more than the international drug conventions. So the way I see it, I think the problem is not just that prohibitionist ideas have been appropriated by the post-colonial state and society, but the real problem is that they believe that this is the right thing to do, that it is right to criminalize drugs, it's right to criminalize psychoactive substances, and a glimpse of which can be seen in how the Indian Supreme Court, which struck down the anti-homosexuality law in Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code by decrying its colonial origins, believes that it is right to criminalize people who use or are involved with drugs. It is right to cancel bail given to people accused of drug offenses. And it is absolutely right to say, as it has done in a recent judgment, that poverty is not a mitigating factor in sentencing for drug offenses. And it was a case of, a very poor person who was, simply a courier. But the court said that there is no question of reducing the sentence because drug crimes are more heinous than murder and deserve absolutely no leniency. So really, I think while it's important to interrogate the origins of modern day drug control and the colonial influence is absolutely clear, but simply recalling its colonial past is not good enough, in my opinion, because as I said, this mindset is now very deeply entrenched. And I think apart from pointing out the origins, it's also important to point out the lack of reason, the lack of rationality, science and humanity in current drug policies.
That was Trippi Tandon, Deputy Director of the Lawyers Collective in India, speaking on a panel entitled Decolonizing Drug Policy, Dismantling Racism and Colonialism Through Drug Policy Reform, which was organized recently by Harm Reduction International. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.